We're going to do a part two, put it online at democracynow.org. Ariel Deranger is Executive Director of Indigenous Climate Action. I'll be speaking in Atlanta, Georgia on Saturday at 5 o'clock. Check our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. It's 7:59. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up in 3 minutes, Native Voices from the Edge with our guest hosts, Carrie and Amory from the Native American Youth and Family Center. Don't go away.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Village Building Convergence, taking place June 1st through 10th at locations all over Portland. The Village Building Convergence features over 30 community-built projects happening all over Portland, including the Mudbone Community Farm, Sherritt Square, and Portland University. Additionally, there are also ticketed evening events featuring speakers and local musicians. Again, that's the Village Building Convergence, taking place June 1st through 10th at locations all over Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pandit Ramdas Palsule Tabla Show on Friday, June 1st at 7:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Portland. Ramdas Palsule is an accomplished soloist as well as a versatile accompanist on the tabla who has performed widely in the eminent music festivals of India and all over the world. Again, that's the Pandit Ramdas Palsule Tabla Show on Friday, June 1st at 7:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center, 5431 Northeast 20th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of An Evening with Jeff Cohen on Sunday, June 3rd at 6:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Jeff Cohen is the founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, commentator, filmmaker, and author. The evening includes a talk and discussion after the screening of his documentary film, All Governments Lie, which celebrates independent journalists. Again, that's Evening with Jeff Cohen on Sunday, June 3rd at 6:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 8:02 and you are listening to Native Voices from the Edge.
Hey, hey, hey. Oh, oh, oh. Whoa. We are all one people and we have to reunite. I say better gather up our warriors, cause tonight is the big fight. Hey, 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 hey. Oh, 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 oh. Hey, 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 hey. Oh, 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 oh.
I'm Amory Shack.
And I'm Carrie Waters.
Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Press Watch, Per Fegerin, sorry if I pronounced that wrong, welcomes producer Jeff Cohen to talk about his film, All Governments Lie, Truth, Deception, and the Spirit of I.F. Stone, showing Sunday at the First Unitarian Church. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, David Naiman talks to author Azarine Van Gerfleet Umi about her highly acclaimed new novel, Call Me Zebra. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
We're going to go ahead and get started, diving right into our conversation. In the first half, we'll be joined by Maggie Talmadge, who is here in the studio with us right now. And during the second half, we'll continue the conversation and take calls. So be ready. The number to call in is 503-231-8187. So we'll begin with Maggie Talmadge, citizen of the Cherokee Nation and environmental justice manager at the Coalition of Communities of Color. Welcome, Maggie.
Thank you, Carrie.
So glad to have you with us this morning. Let's go ahead and get started with an introduction. Could you just share a bit about who you are, your background, so folks know who's with us this morning?
Yeah, well, thank you. And I wish all the listeners were able to see Carrie's dance moves to that intro song. It made my day. So I'm coming here today. I think, you know, how I usually like to start my introductions is talking about my family. So my grandmother was actually born in 1907 in Indian Territory, which is now Oklahoma. She was born to the Onawea clan, or Wolf clan. And 6 months later, after she was born, what was promised to remain Indian Territory forever became the state of Oklahoma. 1907 was also the year that Oklahoma, or Indian Territory's oil production exceeded any other jurisdiction or state in the nation. So that kind of led me to my interest, pursuing racial justice, environmental justice, climate justice. And my family really raised me knowing a Cherokee concept or Chalagi concept called Gadugi, which means to come together to solve a problem. So these interests really led me to the Coalition of Communities of Color, where I am today.
That's right. And how long have you been at the CCC?
So I joined the Coalition of Communities of Color in 2015. The coalition was actually formed in 2001. It's an alliance of 19 culturally specific community-based organizations. And these organizations came together to address inequities of services, socioeconomic disparities, and institutional racism faced by our communities here in the Portland and Oregon region.
That's great. And how can you share the story about how you specifically got connected with the CCC, maybe some of the players that you had known and got connected with?
You mean you, Carrie? So I moved back to Portland. I went to high school outside of Eugene, and I moved back to Portland after graduating from Wellesley College outside of Boston. And I immediately plugged into the Native community, which is the community that raised me, taught me my values. And I met with the previous executive director of the Native American Youth and Family Center, Matt Morton. And it kind of took over from there. I got involved with the Portland Youth and Elders Council, which is housed at NEA. I met Tony DeFalco, who I believe was on the show last week, or was recently on the show.
A show. I think another show on KBO.
Yes. And I got roped into really volunteering with NEA, with VEDE, which is another organization of color in the Coley neighborhood. And eventually this role opened up and it was a perfect fit, mm-hmm. The dream job.
Mm-hmm. And previously you had been at Eco Districts, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. That reminded me of, you know, our Living Coley partnership. For those who aren't aware, the Native American Youth and Family Center, Verde, Hacienda CDC, and Habitat for Humanity, Portland Metro East, are all in relationship in what is known as the Living Coley Partnership, which redefines sustainability at the neighborhood scale. So it's kind of like an eco district, but very much centered on equity first and foremost as a pillar of environmental investments, because we know that so often environmental investments come into a community and the people who have suffered in place for decades, centuries even, oftentimes don't get to stay and enjoy those benefits. So what were some of your initial priorities when you came on as environmental justice manager at the CCC, and how has that led into your work that you're focused on today?
Yeah. First and foremost, before I forget, I need to make a plug. We have our summer soiree coming up on June 12th, the Coalitions. Mm. So check out our website for tickets and sponsorships.
Mm-hmm.
There's my shameless
plug.
Love
it.
So I was hired in 2015, but I'm going to backtrack a little bit. So in 2013, the Coalitions organizations made their first explicit environmental goals, recognizing that sustainability and environmental initiatives are a way to meet traditional social service and community development goals, and that they can actually serve as anti-poverty solutions, similar to you know, the Living Clay model. So I came in and I was hired in 2015, early 2015, to essentially staff the Community and Economic Development Committee focused on anti-displacement and anti-gentrification, to staff on environmental and climate justice. And some of the initial projects that I engaged on were developing a climate resilience plan with the Native American Youth and Family Center, Opal Environmental Justice, and a number of our member organizations. So specifically a climate resilience plan that centers low-income communities and communities of color, driving solutions created by our communities. I've been working the past 3 years on carbon pricing at the state level to ensure that voices of color, low-income communities are centered in those conversations. We've done a lot of work on developing an agenda that speaks to our communities. And we officially formed the Redefine program, our environmental and climate justice program, which really the goal of Redefine is to broaden the climate and environmental justice movement here in Portland, here in Oregon, so that it proactively advances climate solutions that close opportunity gaps experienced by our communities. And we do this through education engagement, leadership development, policy analysis and advocacy, strengthen communications, and more importantly, strengthen relationships.
Love this. And I know that this is happening across our nation, even worldwide, that folks are recognizing that we have to center communities of color and other frontline communities who are impacted most by the impacts of climate change, the interconnected systems of oppression that have led us to this place. And, you know, we've realized that Portland, you know, we're oftentimes in this little Portland bubble, lots of great progressive things going on, and at the same time, our communities are often left behind, which leads me to our next question about the first major environmental mm-hmm. initiative led by communities of color yeah. in the city of Portland. So in our Native communities, creation stories are very important to us, whether it's where our people come from or the beginning of an effort. So could you share with us the origin story of what is now known as the Portland Clean Energy Fund?
Of course. Very excited to do so. I think by backing up and kind of reflecting on what you said, Carrie, is that here in Portland, nationally, for too long, our communities, low-income communities, communities of color, have been bypassed for investments, environmental, sustainability, climate investments, and instead, wealthier neighborhoods are often the ones that benefit from the environmental benefits. And even the wealth creation opportunities. And instead, our communities are the dumping grounds, whether here in Portland, if we're thinking about highways built in our neighborhoods, if we're thinking about lack of tree canopy. In the Coley neighborhood alone, it's 9 degrees warmer than the rest of the city simply because it's filled with concrete and lacks tree canopy. So, the way that we've been approaching through Redefine our work is that we need to provide benefit, we need to prevent harm, and we need to ensure inclusive and accountable decision making. Because not only do we always get the bad stuff, and then lack investments in the good stuff, we're often excluded and historically have been from the decision making around policies, investments, and initiatives. So the Portland Clean Energy Fund is really the solution to this. It is an environmental justice initiative run by organizations of color. The first that we know of, particularly in the city of Portland and maybe even in the state, a ballot measure run by organizations of color. And so 2.5 years ago, I'd say we, the Native American Youth and Family Center, the Coalition of Communities of Color, VEDDE, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, and NAACP Portland got involved and started partnering with 350 PDX. Came about a solution. How do we build environmental and climate resiliency in our community while addressing the intersecting issues of growing inequities, racial and economic inequities in our communities? And how do we do this through a progressive funding mechanism? So what we came up with was the Portland Clean Energy Fund initiative, which will generate at least $30 million a year for investments in things like rooftop solar, energy efficiency, weatherization, sustainable agricultural projects. And a big portion is around job training, contractor support, particularly for underserved communities, i.e. communities of color, chronically underemployed, folks with disabilities, women. And it does this by leveraging a small 1% surcharge on billionaire national retail corporations that earn also, so tier one, billionaire national retail corporations. And the second criteria is they have to earn over $500,000 a year within the city of Portland.
That's great. So exciting. Thank you so much for sharing that foundation of Portland Clean Energy Fund. So how has this initiative evolved? How, you know, have more organizations come on board in the past year, in the past couple of years? What has that coalition building looked like?
Yeah. It's been organic because the initiative sells itself. And I think people are craving leadership and solutions by and for organizations and communities of color. People see that certain Portlanders are hit worse by climate change, are hit worse by the pollution that causes it, and are experiencing the brunt of growing inequality. So since that date, we've added on, I believe we're over 175 endorsers, which include faith communities, include labor unions, include housing providers, architects, small businesses, solar associations, elected officials. The list goes on. It's a broad coalition because this is a broad issue. It hits us all.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is an impressive list. Folks can check it out at portlandcleanenergyfund.com. So one issue that's impacted us all, I think, throughout the Portland metro region is our housing crisis. So will this help with our housing crisis? If so, how?
Yeah, I mean, we're all feeling the strain, right? And I think a big piece of housing costs are utility bills. Energy burden is disproportionately high for folks of color, for folks with low incomes. And utility bills are the number one reason why people take out payday and predatory loans in the United States. And again, lack of access to living wage jobs is an issue that disproportionately impacts people of color and people with low incomes. And this obviously directly attributes to an ability to afford housing. So again, creates the jobs to provide steadier wages and employment for people seeking housing, and also lowers energy bills and can prevent particularly a lot of that cyclical nature of loans and payday loans.
Yes. What about for folks listening? How can people, you know, what can they do to join the movement or to spread the word about the Portland Clean Energy Fund?
I think first and foremost, go to the website, portlandcleanenergyfund.com. I think you just listed it up. There's a number of ways. So right now, we're in the phase to gather signatures to put the initiative on the November 2018 ballot. We need almost 36,000 signatures. So we need people to hit the streets. We need people to show up to events and gather signatures from Portland voters. You can stop by the Sierra Club for one. Audubon holds trainings. A number of our other organizations are holding trainings. So you can pick up your petition kit, learn more about the Portland Clean Energy Fund and how to talk about it, and learn the process for gathering signatures. That training, probably 15 minutes. So stop by, pick up your petition kit, and hit the streets. You can also go on to our website and donate. The Portland Clean Energy Fund has launched a crowdfunding campaign. We're seeking $30,000. That's our bare minimum goal, to get 30,000 dollars within the next month or two. And that'll help fund, again, our organizations to work on this, work with communities that have not been engaged in political and ballot measure campaigns, and to build capacity in our organizations to do this work long term. You can also wear a Portland Clean Energy Fund t-shirt. We're making those right now. We don't have them yet, but we would love everyone to hold them, to have them. And then, of course, when it comes to November, vote yes.
Sweet. I really hope we get to that place to qualify with
the
necessary
track.
Signatures. So exciting. So exciting. There's been so much momentum. Every time I'm out and about going to meetings, on the bus, I see volunteer signature gatherers and folks. Folks are out there in full force. I really see the people power behind this ballot measure. It's so exciting to see folks get energized about a local solution like this, because we know that, you know, the federal government, the national political landscape isn't conducive to addressing the solutions that our communities are facing on the ground.
And I think Portlanders, by and large, want corporations to pay their fair share and want them to be good neighbors and invest in local solutions that really drive community and climate resilience.
Yes, agreed. So we have an event tonight, in case folks are interested, a PSEF signature gathering training at 350 PDX at 6:30 p.m. There's also another event coming up, and you can see all of these events on the Portland Clean Energy Fund Facebook page. Friday evening, tomorrow evening, oh my goodness, short week, there's a bridges, networking, skill building, and leadership development opportunity within the Coalition of Communities of Color. So we've got something for everyone else this evening, and then some focused opportunities as well. So that's very, very exciting. Well, we've got just a couple minutes left with Maggie. So let's see. Another question that I think is important for us to address is, why retail corporations?
Good. I'm glad you brought that up. So I think retail corporations, right? Those are the corporations that have some of the longest and dirtiest supply chains. And our current policies are not accounting for those greenhouse gas emissions, nor is it accounting for low wages, nor is it accounting for the fact that those retail corporations often invest less in local communities than our homegrown businesses. Mm-hmm. And these are corporations that set their prices on a national level and won't be passing on those that small increase down to consumers. We see, for example, in California, stores with higher electricity rates or higher taxes, the prices set at the prices for those retail goods are the same as what we see in Oregon. So we're looking for solutions that, again, address climate change, address income inequality, and ensure that this isn't going to be felt by everyday Portlanders.
That reminds me of the video, The Story of Stuff by Annie Leonard, which is so powerful. If folks would like to check it out, it's on YouTube, The Story of Stuff.
What is that?
So it outlines our materials economy and goes through this supply chain that Maggie has referenced, which is a linear system. But we live in a finite world, and we can't operate within this linear mindset forever. We're going to run ourselves into the ground. You know, we've globally mismanaged our ecosystem and our economies, and we need to look to local solutions like Portland Clean Energy Fund.
Mm-hmm. And I think another point, too, is that these retail corporations are not paying their fair share in taxes. They've got record low tax rates. And then thank you again to the federal administration, as they just were handed a huge windfall. Mm-hmm. And of the maybe 125 companies that could be affected by this, 45 have overseas tax havens. So clearly, they're not focusing their dollars in local solutions. And even on the flip side, what we've seen, according to the U.S. Department of Energy, for every $1 invested in weatherization, $1.72 is generated in energy benefits, and $2.78 is generated in non-energy benefits, such as fewer medical bills and less work time lost. So we also have to think about these external costs and benefits. And I think the Portland Clean Energy Fund really gets at those.
That's great. Thank you so much. Well, I know you've got other commitments this morning, Maggie. So thank you so much for joining us to talk about the Portland Clean Energy Fund. And remind me again, when is this CCC soiree?
Oh, yes. The CCC soiree is June 12th. So head to our website, buy tickets. Sponsor. And if you want to volunteer, we're welcoming that as well. Hope to see you all there.
CoalitionCommunitiesColor.org.
Thank you.
That is right.
Great.
Thank you, Carrie and Amory.
Thank you, Maggie.
Yes.
Fabulous. So now we'll be transitioning. We're going to keep the conversation going. Had such a great time last week.
We did.
That was super duper fun.
Just a quick reminder, too, we will be taking calls for this portion of the show. So call in 503-231-8187.
That's right.
That's the number.
Love it. So pivoting a bit, you know, we work on issues at the local level, because we know that, you know, that's where you can have really significant impact. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's interaction at all scales. So, you know, there are federal funding sources that are funneled through the state and the county and the cities ultimately. And likewise with state funding. So I think we'll go ahead and pick up our conversation where we left off last week by having a little chat about House Bill 2017, Keep Oregon Moving. So this was the transportation package that was passed last year in the 2017 legislative full session. So in the legislature, every year alternates. There's a full session, then there's a short session, then full session, short session, etc. So in the last full session, the transportation package was passed, and we were very excited about this opportunity to bring in over $100 million of funding towards active transportation infrastructure and transit operations. And there are many elements to the transportation package. There was a declaration to do a feasibility study on the potential use of congestion pricing, which for those that don't know, it's also called value pricing. It means that there could be tolls or some other user fee on I-5 and I-205 here in the Portland metro area. So there's a feasibility study that's happening this year. And so that's just one element. There are some understandable concerns about this, you know, potentially being a regressive funding mechanism and disproportionately burdening communities of color and low-income folks. But, you know, there's also lots of really great things that are happening as well. Like, for example, this, you know, the $103 million that will be allocated. You know, some of that funding is coming through TriMet. So there are some TriMet budget workshops happening. A couple happened last week. A couple more are coming up in June. And I believe that they are all full. Otherwise, I would share. I guess I can share the link for folks if you are interested. It's tinyurl.com/HB2017budget. So IRCO, the Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, has been working with other community organizations to recruit within communities of color and low-income folks to help inform these priorities. So the funding mechanism here is also regressive. It's a wage tax, but it's still an opportunity to be leveraged within our communities. Oftentimes, because of the highway trust fund at the state level, funding related to transportation is constrained to capital improvements only, like a new sidewalk or, you know, road improvements. But while this funding mechanism is a wage tax, that still opens up opportunities for service enhancements, for better TriMet service, and operations expenses. So that's very exciting. Also associated with this whole package was the low income fare, which Opal Environmental Justice Oregon and many partners had been fighting for years. And it was finally decided that through this funding that the low income fare will finally be implemented. So we're super excited. There's just so many elements to this transportation package. But those budget workshops are happening right now. So
some highlights would be, you know, roads and bridges, better public transportation, improvements to rails and ports for Oregon farms, electric vehicle incentives, safe biking and walking options, reducing congestions, all the things that you were just mentioned too. If you're interested to learn more as well, you can go to, you know, oregon.gov and go to House Bill 2017's at the Oregon Department of Transportation's page for Keep Oregon Moving. And there's some, you know, FAQs and overviews, and that's the way you can learn more and have a, you know, a deep understanding on a personal level.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
And remember, folks, you can call us. At 503-231-8187. What else is happening?
Well, let's talk about Farmville.
Oh, is that your favorite Facebook game?
We have been having this ongoing joke about Farmville sounding like Farmville. And there is a
do not send me any more Farmville requests, Amory.
But it's real.
Yes, it's no laughing matter.
It's no laughing matter. Let's talk about the Farm Bill.
Great. What's happening with the Farm Bill?
Well, I think a lot of people who are listening today know, you know, Republicans in the U.S. Congress have introduced a Farm Bill that would increase hunger and hardship by taking away or cutting food assistance from many struggling families, including children. You know, and their proposal includes sweeping changes to SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or food stamps. Mm-hmm. And this proposal takes SNAP benefits away from people 18 to 59 years old who aren't currently employed or participating in training for 20 hours a week. And so what is happening, why this is current right now, is because the vote on this $867 billion bill will be a revote, will be held on June 22nd. Mm-hmm. It's almost June. It's May 31st.
Sure is. Oh my goodness.
I know.
Time flies.
So if you, you know, are looking for a call to action as well, you know, an optional response would be to call your member of Congress, you know, if that's something that speaks to you. What, you want to talk more about Farm Bill, or what else do you know about the Farm Bill?
I just know the basics. You know, I've heard about SNAP benefits getting cut. And I just think about the long history of agriculture subsidies to these large-scale corporations and, you know, the ultimate poisoning of our communities, you know, through cheap processed foods and commodities. And, you know, it just makes me think about solutions like Portland Clean Energy Fund, which can help to support locally produced agriculture. Right. And ultimately, this being an energy justice issue, you know, we think about food, you know, we take in calories to give us energy. And if we're able to tend to our own, you know, small scale farms and gardens, you know, that can help to build food security within our communities in a significant way.
Right.
We've got a call from Lou. Lou, you are on the air.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So it looks like you touched on a couple things there. The Farm Bill, which apparently has a local comic historical thing. And it sounded like you also talked about transportation, perhaps TriMet stuff.
Correct.
So do you know where Oregon is ranked now on food insecurity? At one point, it was in the bottom five, which seemed counterintuitive.
That is a great question. I don't know
or as an alternate question, for the Farm Bill in whatever shape it might wind up in, do you know the specific dollar amount that the Republicans wanted to cut food stamps or SNAP by?
Well, to answer your first question, just from a resource from OPB on May 17th, it says that over the last decade, Oregon's national ranking for food insecurity has improved from close to the worst to now 14th, is the exact phrase. So 14th
worst then, or?
Yes.
So it would be like number 35, roughly.
Yeah, so Oregon Food Bank also has some stats from this past month. While the economy has improved for some, we still have 1 in 7 neighbors facing food insecurity. And in an average month, an estimated 260,000 people are receiving food from a food pantry in the Oregon Food Bank statewide network of 21 regional food banks and approximately 1,200 food assistance sites.
I should probably say, since you're quoting food bank stuff, as someone who used to be the fundraiser at a food bank for a couple of years a while back, I raised $330,000 in 2 years at Winter's Interagency Food Bank. Do you know, and it's okay if you don't, do we think that hunger in Oregon, which again seems counterintuitive in a liberal progressive state, is better or worse? Is it the worst it's ever been, even though the economy is supposed to be really good? Was it worse, for example, under Reagan, or do we know?
Great question.
Yeah, I don't have that answer off the top of my head. About 552 900 Oregonians are food insecure.
Sure, yeah, I understand their statistics. I was just curious if, based on your opinions, and it sounds like there's more than one of you today on the program, which may be normal, do you think that, or do you have an explanation about why, if the economy nationally, as Trump likes to say, is doing really well, unemployment's at a, I don't know, 20-year low, why is there food insecurity? Why is there hunger? And why in Oregon specifically?
That is a huge question.
Or is this an opinion question? If you don't know, that's fine.
I have opinions on this, yes. So I would just say that, you know, our economy as a whole in dominant society prioritizes concentration of wealth and power as its definition of success, as opposed to ecological and social well-being. So in the pillars of the economy, we know that we have resources, which in our current extractive economy are extracted, the dig, burn, dump economy, which are produced and, you know, distributed through labor that's exploitative towards this end of concentration of wealth and power under the worldview of white supremacy, consumerism, colonialism, all those interconnected systems of oppression, and enforced through militarism, as opposed to a regenerative economy, which regenerates its resources, produced through cooperative labor towards the end of social and ecological well-being under a worldview of sacredness and caring, and governed through deep democracy. So I would just, you know, I would say that this food insecurity that our people are experiencing here in Oregon and just nationally is a symptom of this larger problem. Because we know that, you know, as Maggie was sharing earlier with these offshore tax havens and these other loopholes and the windfall that billionaire corporations have received recently, that the money is there. You know, we can solve our food insecurity and our crisis with poverty in general, but those funds just haven't been unlocked.
Sure. And then it also sounded like, I don't know if either any of you have networked with or worked with the Poor People's Campaign in Oregon.
That's right, the Poor People's Movement. There are some events coming up soon associated with it.
I was just checking if any of you all have. I've been to some of them in Salem and Portland. Mm-hmm. I was just curious if any of you have, dealing at least with hunger as one particular issue and poverty, mm-hmm. is something that you all have, you know, I don't know, worked on a bit or not so much? Or
that's great. No, I haven't been directly connected to it, but I know folks who have.
Cecil on Monday morning is chairing the meetings. He's the talk show host Monday morning. So Cecil's, if you haven't talked to him, that would be a good resource at your station. You were going to say something, go ahead.
That's great. Thank you so much. Something else that comes to mind for me is this interconnected nature of natural resources restoration and food security issues. You know, the East Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District has some priorities related to community-based agriculture as well as green infrastructure. And through movements like the Native Gathering Garden at Cully Park or other eco-cultural restoration projects that some tribes are taking on and urban Indian community members throughout the city of Portland and beyond, you know, we're trying to reconnect to our traditional food systems that are low maintenance, you know, that are made for this specific environment and ecosystem, and that also play a role in restoration and helping to sink, spread, and slow down our water as opposed to, you know, pumping, piping, and paving. So, you know, as I think about the interconnected nature of all of these issues, that comes to mind as well, to build a food system that will be resilient when the big one hits, the big Cascadia earthquake that we know will happen sooner rather than later. Or, you know, who knows? It might be tomorrow. It might be 100 years from now. But this all makes me think about resilience and how we can mm-hmm. create an economy and a place that is grounded in the traditional wisdom of our landscape that uses, well, that cares for and tends to and harvests traditional plants that can be used for food purposes, for medicinal purposes, etc.
And I guess another specific question, and it's fine if you don't know, but it sounds like you may have mentioned in Portland for November the green tax ballot measure. Was that right? Did you mention that?
That's right, the Portland Clean Energy Fund.
Sure. And do you have any predictions on whether, like, for example, you may be following that very closely, but there's two candidates for Portland City Council who are in a runoff election in November, and one of them supports the green tax, and the other one opposes it. I assume, but I don't know, because I haven't heard you say, if Naya or Naya, for example, supports the green tax.
Yes, we're one of the steering committee member organizations, and if you check out PortlandCleanEnergyFund.com, you'll see all of the endorsing organizations we've got.
And do you have a prediction? Do you think it will pass? A little, a lot, or be defeated?
That's a great question. Based on the momentum that I've been seeing with, volunteer signature gatherers out there, I've been seeing just exponential momentum and excitement throughout our community about this initiative.
But Portland State, we've noticed that at least some of the petition gatherers aren't referring it to as the green tax. They're saying it's for kind of a little bit what you've been saying, sustainable economy and things like that, which maybe that's really helpful for getting people to sign it. The other thing I wanted to ask, because it sounded like you mentioned it, but I'm not sure you've talked about it or worked on it specifically, was TriMet stuff on transportation. Do you know, has there been a group, I know there's two or three nonprofits, that has advocated for the TriMet Board of Directors elected, currently it's appointed by the governor. Do you know about that, or do you have an opinion on, would it be better if the TriMet Board was elected by voters?
Yeah, so that's an interesting concept, and after we address this, we're going to have to take another call. We've got another caller.
Thanks for your help.
So thank you so much, Lou. I'm excited that on that note that we've got three new TriMet directors on their board of directors. Kathy Way, who is an Asian leader from Clackamas County, and two others that are also people of color. So it's very exciting. We've got a majority of people of color on the TriMet board of directors. And there have been conversations about TriMet board reform in the past, whether or not they should be elected or not. And, I think it's kind of a mixed bag because, there are some folks throughout the region who aren't super friendly or in favor of transportation and or public transportation and transit as a service that should be provided across the board. So there are pros and cons to an elected board, for sure.
Let's take another call. Harry, welcome.
Oh, welcome, and thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely.
I was kind of distressed hearing about what you mentioned about the SNAP program. They're trying to cut the funding for it, and it's going to put a lot of stress on local efforts of feeding the poor. Example, a lot of the homeless people who are on SNAP and the 18 to 59 cutting their that's majority of their homeless. I mean, we have a homeless problem, and it's just going to exacerbate the their problems. And also they mentioned the economy is doing well, but technically it isn't, because the unemployment rate, even though it's 4%, it's 4% of people who are getting unemployment only. So if you don't get unemployment, you're not counted, and now you're not going to get no SNAP benefits. That's going to put a lot of distress on a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts on that?
Go for it. Thank you for bringing that up. I think that, I think in all so many places throughout the United States are going to feel the impacts of this decision. And, anywhere where you slash funding or removing families from assistance, and just imposing more barriers, where we already have, statistics in America, like one in out of four children already live in a food insecure household. And so, yes, I think
local to where we are here in Portland, as well as across the nation. This is going to impact, lead to more child hunger and suffering.
Yes, I know. Suffering. That's the word. There's going to be a lot more suffering around the country. Mm-hmm. My next question is, I have an idea for a topic for a show for you.
Okay.
Oh. Okay, well, I'm a numismatist or a coin collector. And the mint, the U.S. Mint, minted the Sacagawean dollar from 2009 to 2017. And on the obverse, the front of it, it shows Sacagawea carrying a baby. On the reverse, each of the different years, they put a different celebrating different Native American history throughout our country. Example, in 2010, on the back of the coin, they talk about Native American steel workers. Mm-hmm. And the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, when they were making steel, majority of the workers at the time were Native American. Mm-hmm. So I was hoping to do maybe a story on these coins, and each back verse talking about Indian heritage.
Mm. Yes, that would be a rich conversation indeed. Thank you for that idea. I am, I guess, sad. I don't know. It's bittersweet to share that this is our last show for the foreseeable future. We've just been helping to take on Voices from the Edge for chunks at a time. So we are here in November. Mm-hmm. We've been here in May helping to cover for, as the other caller mentioned, one of the candidates in the Portland City Council Commissioner
Joanne
number three.
Joanne Hardesty, who everyone knows for. I can say that, you can, but you can't, you know.
But thank you so much. If we do have the opportunity and capacity to take on an additional month sometime before the November election, we'll definitely have this topic.
Yes.
Okay, great.
Thank you for that contribution.
Yeah. Sayonara.
Thank you so
Bye.
Much, Harry.
Bye.
Great. Thank you so much. Shall we move on to another topic?
Let's do it.
Okay.
Let's do it. What else is happening?
I mean, I would love to hear your opinion on just, the public comment period beginning for the Jordan Cove LNG terminal.
Mm.
What are your thoughts?
Yes. So this is an interesting one. One of those classic tension points between jobs and our future. So for those that don't know, there is a proposed project that has been lifted up in the past and that hasn't made it through the permitting process, but has risen once again. It's known as the Pacific Connector Pipeline and Jordan Cove Export Terminal, which would help to transport liquefied natural gas that had been fracked up in Canada to bring it through Oregon and to export it offshore.
Coos Bay.
Correct. Down in Coos Bay is where the Jordan Cove terminal would be sited. So there is a public comment period, which I believe has already started. Let's confirm this. So yes, the public comment period has begun. This has been a controversial pipeline and terminal that has been revived under pressure from our current presidential administration, that's facing another round of scrutiny by the public and the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. So this would be a 230-mile natural gas pipeline that would go over Klamath County, Jackson County, Douglas, and Coos counties. So the DEQ has to issue a permit for water quality certification. And this is really a turning point for us. There have been no other LNG pipelines that have been approved in the state of Oregon. So this would be a major turning point if it does pass. So I know that there are folks down in southern Oregon and Northern California, like the tribes in the area, as well as organizations like Rogue Climate that are trying to elevate this issue and bring awareness around how this could impact traditional homelands and other resources. We talked about the big Cascadia earthquake that will hit sooner or later, and this is in that subduction zone area. So there's lots of risks associated with this project, and some of our listeners in Portland might be wondering, oh, why does this impact me? You know, we live in Portland. We need to focus on Portland issues. But through the relational worldview model that looks at mind, body, spirit, and social context, and all aspects of life as interconnected, I think that helps us to easily see the interconnected nature of all things from our choices up here, you know, as far as our urban environment is built. And I'll also say that with a caveat that for many folks that are living on the front lines of climate change and low-income folks and people of color, that oftentimes our communities don't have that luxury of choice. So it's more about climate justice and systems change as opposed to individual personal climate action, like having a little timer in the shower, for example. So I want to say that with that understanding that we have to address these issues at a systems level if we're seeking justice, as opposed to just pinning the responsibility on individuals to take quote unquote climate action. So this would be an unprecedented project that would be passing through our precious homelands and our state of Oregon. So all of these things are interconnected. Also, you know, I was able to hear from some Klamath and Yurok youth, as well as folks from Rogue Climate last November when they were up here in town. They did a presentation to the public and had several visits. And they shared that, you know, Portland has a platform. So it's really important to talk about these issues, you know, to share the fact that this public comment period is open, to let Governor Brown know how you feel about this issue, and to just do more research and learn more about this issue.
Right. And there's, you know, another opportunity that you could do to share if this is something that, you know, you're looking to be able to speak out about or to be able to have that individual action. An opportunity would be to, you know, submit comments to the DEQ and the U.S. Army Corps as well by July 21st. There's a call out from 350 PDX in terms of being able to, you know, help support and protect. So
that's right. So we'll be closing our time. Amory, it's been wonderful. Fabulous month. Fabulous
yes.
show.
So many great conversations.
So,
I'm just reliving them right now.
I know. I know. I'm so grateful for the internet and
yes.
archival of these shows.
Yes.
Forever.
And I just want to plug one thing before we leave. There was a really great, if you want to continue listening to some of the conversations that we had this month, like the conversation we had earlier with missing and murdered Indigenous women, there's a great podcast that I've been listening to from Connie Walker from it's like I think it's CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Company, and Sweet. They have a podcast called Finding Cleo that is all about, there's two seasons right now, and they're following the history and family relationships within communities impacted by missing and murdered Indigenous women. Very great. I've been binge listening to it, so just wanted
Love
to
it.
Plug that for any listeners who have found these conversations and the threads that connect them impactful, if you want to learn more about Indigenous history.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thanks to all of our listeners and all of our callers. We've been taking those healthy risks and
that is right.
having these conversations and inviting others in. So thank you for all of your contributions. Thanks to John, And up next, we've got Press Watch.
Yes.
Yes.
Have a lovely day. Thank you.
Hey, hey, hey. Oh, oh, oh. Whoa. We are all one people and we have to reunite. I say better gather up our warriors, cause tonight is the big fight. Hey, 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 hey.
It's 8:59. This is KBOO Portland, and Press Watch is next. Teresa Mitchell is on break. Per Fogarang is filling in for her, and he welcomes producer Jeff Cohen to talk about his film All Governments Lie, Truth, Deception, and the Spirit of I.F. Stone, showing Sunday at the First Unitarian Church. Air Cascadia with Chris Andre at 10. 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then coming up at 11 this morning on Between the Covers, David Naiman talks to author Azarine van der Vliet Alumi about her highly acclaimed new novel, Call Me Zebra, and all of this good programming because of KBOO members and your support. So keep informed, get involved by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. It's 9 o'clock.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society's new concert season, which runs September of 2018 through May of 2019. The Portland Folk Music Society is pleased to present a lineup of national and regional artists, including Molly O'Brien and Rich Moore, the Kathy Kallick Band, the Honey Whiskey Trio, Legends of the Celtic Harp with Patrick Ball, True North, Tish Hinojosa, Pat Donahue, Nina Gerber and Chris Webster, and Dave Stamey. For a limited time, the Portland Folk Music Society is offering a season ticket package at a deep discount from regular pricing, but this opportunity runs only through the end of May. For more information, go to kboo.fm, and on the right side of the homepage, click under Community Events.